From Idaho to Florida, New Mexico to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, new national jobs numbers are out. There's good news, but also reason for concern. Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. The U.S. Senate has passed a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, which is a gateway to over $4 trillion in overall new spending. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The United Nations has issued a new climate report. Is it all doom and gloom? Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey from Reason Magazine have the answer. And it is the 40th anniversary of the Reagan tax cuts, which unleashed a 25-year era of economic prosperity. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The July jobs number showed continued progress in reducing unemployment and getting the nation back to work as the economy recovers from the COVID-19 pandemic. Michael Farron is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is here to talk about the impact of the jobs report. Michael, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Michael, the jobs numbers are out for the month of July, and you interestingly said, quote, "so foul and fair a jobs report I have not seen." That would seem to be somewhat contradictory. Does that reflect what the report showed?
I think it's a fair assessment of the report, although most everyone is focusing on the fair, and very few people have seen that there is a dark lining to this silver cloud.
Before we go any further, tell us a little bit more about the report. What happened with the unemployment rate, and what did it have to say about the direction of the U.S. economy?
Number of payroll jobs rose by about 950,000, and the previous 2 months' worth of payroll job estimates were increased by about another 100,000. So payroll employment rose by around 1 million jobs in this jobs report. And one of the really hopeful signs to that is that there was an enormous decline in the number of workers who were on temporary layoff. And those are the workers who I've been paying special attention to, because you see those workers start to rejoin their jobs instead of shifting from temporary layoff to permanent layoff, essentially temporary furlough to permanent layoff, then the economy is moving in the right direction. If it's going the other direction, so they are kind of the canary in the coal mine. And one more good month of a 400,000 or 500,000 drop in the number of temporary furloughed workers will bring us back to February 2020's level of the number of furloughed workers in the labor force. And that will honestly be the first statistic to resume its pre-pandemic level.
As you look at these numbers, does this clearly show that the United States is starting to emerge from the economic devastation of the COVID-19 pandemic?
I would say that's a really good sign, yes. And like I said, the canary in the coal mine, those temporary furloughed workers, the fact that so many of them have been recalled to their jobs, the canary is singing. Things are going very well. There is, as I mentioned, a dark lining to the silver cloud, however, and that is the fact that the unemployment rate dropped by 0.5 percentage points, one of the largest month-over-month drops in history. This is actually a problem from my perspective. Not many people have picked up on that, because essentially what you've had is 1 million workers get new jobs or return to their old jobs. But you've only had about 250,000 workers enter the labor market. And there's still about 3 million people who were in the labor market back in February 2020, who have not rejoined the labor market in an active way. They may be unemployed in the sense that they would like a job, but they are not actively searching for a job. And so as a result, they are not included in the estimates of these labor market statistics. So at that point, economists can start arguing over whether or not the federal expansion to unemployment benefits has had an effect in essentially inhibiting workers from returning to the labor market with full vigor.
Expand upon that a little bit, Michael. Your thoughts on whether or not these continued expansion of the federal unemployment benefit, do you see it as really causing a labor shortage here?
Let me take you back in history a little bit to answer that question. And it's not too long. It just goes back to April when vaccines had become readily available, but still not many people had them. And there were arguably three main reasons that were continually quoted as potential reasons why the April jobs numbers and general jobs growth in the spring was not as strong as what economists and many people had expected as we emerged from the shadow of the pandemic. And, or at least what we thought was an emergence from the shadow of the pandemic, Delta variant notwithstanding. So those three reasons were, one, people were justifiably afraid of the virus and were avoiding returning to work because of that. Two, they were providing family care either for elderly relatives or children, and essentially they needed time to shift their schedules around in order to allow them to rejoin the labor force. And three, the federal expansion unemployment benefits, the additional $300 a week that was provided on top of the standard state unemployment benefits, which had been extended by the federal government through early September. And that extra $300 a week still was replacing a large chunk, in some cases, even up to a full wage replacement for some of the service sector workers who were hardest hit by the pandemic. At this point, however, vaccines are readily available. That argument seems to be mostly gone. We've had multiple months for families to reorganize their schedules. And on top of that, we are in summer, which is a normal time that families would have to find alternative means of childcare other than schooling. So at this point, it really feels like we are getting to the point where there's not many arguments left other than the federal expansion to unemployment benefits. And we'll get some more data at the state level in about 2 weeks. And there's been a real nice, what economists call natural experiment, in that in May, about 26 governors abruptly decided to exit the federal expanded unemployment benefits because states were given that option. So there's 26 states that around late June ended their participation in the program and 24 states that did not. So we'll see when the state specific July jobs numbers come out in mid-August. The national numbers came out at the beginning of August. The state-specific numbers are released later, and metropolitan-specific numbers are released at the end of August. We'll get a chance to see whether the states that preemptively exited the program showed stronger employment growth out of trend compared to the 24 states that remained in the program. And so we're finally to the point where we can start addressing and quantifying some of this effect. I think it's fair to say that each of those arguments did have their own effect, and that effect probably changes over time. It's all up to the economists to argue about what the size of the effect is, I suppose. That's the right way to understand it.
We have been talking with Michael Farron, who is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center, which, of course, is at George Mason University. Michael, tell us just a bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go online to read your writings on this and other topics?
The Mercatus Center is a university research center, as you said, based at George Mason University. If you want to read more about my writing, you can follow me on Michael D. Farron, F-A-R-R-E-N, at Twitter and on Mercatus.org.
Michael Farron of the Mercatus Center. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth. There is a lot of activity on Capitol Hill these days. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with the infrastructure bill, Scott. $1.2 trillion in so-called infrastructure passed the Senate. Tell us what occurred.
Well, what occurred was you had a bunch of Rhino Republican senators basically crossing party lines to vote with every single Democrat and pass the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package, a major feather in the cap for President Biden as he works to enact his radical agenda. What this bill did was spent $1.2 trillion of taxpayer money, including $550 billion that was new money added to the what they call the baseline. It increases revenues and taxes by over $50 billion and even includes a pilot program for a per-mile vehicle tax. So they're going to basically be inserting GPS systems into a number of vehicles to test whether or not it makes sense for the federal government to tax the American people on every mile that they drive, another radical idea. And so why would 19 Senate Republicans join hands with all the Democrats, including Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden, to enact this bill is beyond me. But obviously, we've always joked that there are three parties in Washington, including the Democrats, the Republicans, and the appropriators. But here you've got a lot of moderate establishment Republicans, including the Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, that ended up voting for final passage on the Senate bill. So I think it's actually pretty important to go through the list and let the voters know exactly which senators were voting with these Democrats. And so I'm just going to run through the list really quickly. You've got Roy Blunt from Missouri, Richard Burr from North Carolina, Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, Susan Collins from Maine, Kevin Cramer from North Dakota, Mike Crapo from Indiana, Deb Fischer from Nebraska, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Chuck Grassley from Iowa. You've got John Hoeven from North Dakota. You've also got Mitch McConnell, like I mentioned, from Kentucky. Lisa Murkowski, one of Donald Trump's favorite senators, I say that tongue-in-cheek, from Alaska. And then you've got Rob Portman from Ohio, Jim Risch from Idaho, Mitt Romney from Utah, Dan Sullivan from Alaska, Tom Tillis from North Carolina, and wrapping us out is Roger Wicker from Mississippi. So these are a lot of states that think that their infrastructure is collapsing, but obviously in a lot of these states, one of the other senators voted against the bill. And so I think it's a real vulnerability for the four Senate Republicans that joined with the Democrats that are actually up for re-election, and that includes John Hoeven from North Dakota, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Mike Crapo from Idaho, and Chuck Grassley from Iowa. Obviously, those senators have been around for a long time, but we'll see if they get reelected. So what this did was it created a sequence of accommodating basically $4.7 trillion in spending, because as soon as the Senate wrapped up their work on the $1.2 trillion package, they began consideration of the Senate budget resolution, S-Con Res 14, which meant that there was a late night of dozens of amendments that got voted on, and then they passed that bill out 50-49 in the wee hours of earlier this week. And that bill will include the reconciliation instructions for the $3.5 trillion spending package that actually Nancy Pelosi wants to see passed first before the House will take up consideration of the $1.2 trillion package. So after the budget resolution passed the Senate, Nancy Pelosi did a call with the Democratic caucus in the House and announced that the House would be returning from its August recess on August 23rd to consider that budget resolution so that they can do reconciliation. So the whole time that all this is going on, I just want everybody to understand that $4.7 trillion is a massive amount of money. And this is really difficult to measure in terms of the impact on the U.S. economy, what it means for inflation, what it means for future tax increases. As part of the $3.5 trillion plan, Joe Biden is proposing rolling back most of the Trump tax cuts and also going above and beyond that with a $2.3 trillion tax increase, which would be the largest tax increase in American history. So we've got a lot going on here, and that's just getting us started, not even yet talking about what's going on next with the debt limit.
And, of course, the Democrats on a spend and tax binge. Let's talk a little bit more about the debt limit before we wrap up here, Scott. That's rapidly approaching here, as is the budget deadline, which is October 1st. So what's happening with the debt limit?
The debt limit has been a big debate kind of in closed doors over Capitol Hill for the last several weeks. On July 31st, the suspension of the debt limit expired, so you had Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen calling on Congress to take up a clean debt limit increase in a bipartisan fashion. They want to tack that on to the continuing resolution before September 30th. And, you know, what a debt limit suspension looks like is different than a debt limit increase. A suspension just allows Treasury to basically borrow unlimited amounts of money for a certain date. So if we suspended the debt limit through, let's say, December 30th, whatever Congress authorized in terms of spending would not be subject to the current limit. Then when the debt limit suspension ends, it automatically takes on all that debt that's happened in the intervening period. So a lot of Republicans want to see transparency, and they want to see a process where we bring back a dollar amount to the debt limit increase. And what we've seen is some Senate Republicans, in fact, 46 of them, signed a pledge this week to say they would not vote with Democrats to increase the debt limit. And that's trying to force the Democrats' hands to increase the debt limit through the reconciliation package.
We will continue to keep an eye on this because obviously we're going to have a very white-hot end of August here, and I'm not talking about the temperature outside, but with action in the nation's capital. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington. We're united in this idea of economic freedom and fiscal responsibility and opportunity. And so if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The latest United Nations climate report has generated some sensational headlines. But Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey of Reason Magazine take a closer look.
The UN's climate change report released this week was a, quote, code red for humanity. At least that's the headline that a lot of newspapers and prominent online outlets went with. But the truth of the matter is that most of the really dire predictions in that UN climate report are unlikely to come true. And the ones that are more likely to happen in the next few years, as the planet does warm up a bit, are things that humanity should and will be able to mitigate. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Ron Bailey. He is Reason's science correspondent, a colleague of mine, and he's also the author of the book, The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. And he joins us now on the phone to talk about the doom and gloom of this UN climate report. Ron, thanks for taking some time with us.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
You wrote this book, The End of Doom, and I mention that because the reports, the media coverage, at least this week, surrounding this new UN report on climate change has been very doomy. We're not at the end of doom. We're maybe just at the beginning of it, or like, I don't know, it's inevitable, right? Like, what has the media missed in the way they've covered this?
Well, first of all, the new report, they come out basically every 8 years or so. The climate scientists say it is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, ocean, and land. That is a done deal. We know that. The planet is getting warmer, and humanity is causing it by loading up the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. What the media focused on were the worst-case scenarios that were put out in the new report, and those are incredibly, almost entirely unlikely to occur over the course of this coming century. So the really good news is that the more intermediate scenario is the most likely one, and the planet will warm up maybe 2.5-3 degrees if we don't do anything, though I think we are going to do something. And that would not be a catastrophe. It would be challenging. We'd have to adapt to it, but the end of the world is not nigh.
I am inclined to believe that global warming is happening just because of, I'm sitting here in sort of north central Virginia, not that far from where you are, Ron, and this summer has been brutally hot. It is incredibly hot today. So I guess, like, on, you know, at least in the short term, I'm willing to believe that these things are happening. And then I think, to your point, media always, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? We tend to exaggerate. We tend to look for worst case scenarios, maybe to the detriment of actually informing people. So in the interest of actually informing people, people about what's more likely to happen. What are those intermediate scenarios that you were just talking about? What does that mean for the planet? Does it mean New York City gets washed away? Probably not, but like, what do we actually expect to see?
Well, some of the things that we are likely to see is increasing sea level. I mean, that's going to happen because when the ocean water gets warmer, it expands and occupies obviously more space. And also land glaciers and ice sheets are melting, and they're melting at accelerated rates, and they're going to increase average sea level. Again, it's going to be, you know, the way to think about it is over the last century, average sea level increased by 8 inches on the planet Earth. And it might be maybe double that, maybe 20 inches by the end of the century, which is not great. There's going to be extra flooding. People in Florida should be careful about this kind of thing. But again, I think it's the kind of thing that humanity will, a much richer humanity by the end of the 21st century will be able to cope with. That would be one consequence. Another one is obviously the temperatures will be going up, so heat waves will become a lot more common. Probably a heat wave that might have occurred every 50 years will now be occurring every 10 years, that kind of thing. So you're definitely going to have more of that kind of activity going on. Again, not a catastrophe, but not great.
We're talking with Ron Bailey. He's the science correspondent for Reason magazine. You could check out his latest piece at Reason about how the scariest predictions in this new UN climate change report are exaggerated, and they probably exceed what is likely. Ron, I want to finish on kind of the optimistic note here, because this is a point that you make all the time in the pages of Reason and in the pages of the books you've written about the ways in which some of these trade-offs, the environment getting warmer or global warming happening, are really trade-offs for humanity becoming more prosperous, right? Like if we just shut down all fossil fuel emissions tomorrow, that might curb some of these things, but like we would all be worse off for that.
That's absolutely correct. What we're going to have to do is transition away from fossil fuels over the course of this century. And there are technologies out there being developed that are very likely will be able to do this. They'll be slightly more costly. But already, a lot of the renewables are becoming cheaper. And of course, I believe that there will be a nuclear revival as well at some point later in the century with newer, better reactors. So I don't think it's going to be an insuperable problem. And another way to think about it is even in the worst case scenario that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report had, humanity would be basically, the average person on planet Earth right now is making about $12,000 to $13,000 per year, obviously not evenly distributed, but by the end of the century, that'll be about $60,000. So a much richer humanity would be able to take it, to mitigate, to adapt to whatever the changes in the weather that we're causing to occur, when they occur.
Yeah, certainly everything is trade-offs in life, and a warming planet, one of those negative trade-offs for the economic prosperity that we get to enjoy, and hopefully we will continue to enjoy throughout the rest of the 21st century. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today, so we'll have to leave it there. Folks, check out Ron's coverage of the UN climate change report at reason.com. The headline there, the scariest predictions in the new UN climate report are also the most unlikely. Ron, thanks for taking some time with us and walking us through all of this today.
Thank you very much.
And once again, that is Ron Bailey. He is Reason's science correspondent. And if you want a bit more optimism about the state of the world and where things are heading, check out his latest book, 10 Global Trends That Every Smart Person Should Know. You can find that on Amazon.com or wherever you go to find your books, to get your books. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Kemp-Roth tax cuts of 1981 were signed into law by President Ronald Reagan and resulted in an unparalleled era of economic prosperity. Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council takes a look at why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This weekend, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Economic Recovery Tax Act. President Ronald Reagan signed this groundbreaking tax legislation into law on August 13th of 1981 from his beloved Rancho del Cielo, overlooking the beautiful hills outside of Santa Barbara, California. These pro-taxpayer reforms, also known as the Kemp-Roth tax cuts, named after congressional champions Representative Jack Kemp of New York and Senator William Roth of Delaware, substantially reduced the top individual federal income tax rate from an uncompetitive 70% all the way down to 50%. The bill also reduced business taxes and indexed personal income tax brackets for inflation. More importantly for all of us, these tax cuts, along with the 1986 Tax Reform Act, are collectively known as the Reagan tax cuts and permanently enhanced American competitiveness, ushering in an era of unprecedented economic growth. I recently had the chance to sit down with economic guru and Reagan economic advisor, Dr. Arthur B. Laffer, at the ALEC annual meeting in Salt Lake City, Utah. He was extremely proud that the 1981 tax relief package did not simply create the Reagan economic boom of the 1980s, but it also started the transformational policy change that allowed for long-term growth across the United States. According to Dr. Laffer, we saw a tripling in the net wealth of U.S. households and businesses from $20 trillion in 1981, pre-tax cuts, to $60 trillion by 2007. Put another way, after adjusting for inflation, more wealth was created in this 25-year boom than in the previous 200 years of American history. I think it's important to remember that the 1981 Reagan tax cuts didn't just change the course of federal tax policy. States also replicated this pro-growth success by reducing their own tax rates, and many continued to do so. All told, in the past 8 years alone, nearly 40 states have substantially reduced their tax burdens. The case studies from these states exemplify how states can indeed be the laboratories of democracy, as described by United States Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Every year, I have the privilege of co-authoring the national economic study Rich States, Poor States, the ALEC Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index, along with my co-authors Dr. Laffer and Stephen Moore. We analyze how tax rates and economic competitiveness drives income, population, and job growth across states. Consistent with sizable majority of academic research and alongside a healthy dose of common sense and historical background, we find that tax policy is indeed a key driver for economic competitiveness. People and businesses often seek out lower tax burdens across state lines. Rich States, Poor States data show that states that keep taxes low, avoid job-killing overregulation, and follow prudent budget practices consistently and significantly outperform their highly taxed and overregulated counterparts. The key in having competitive tax rates and eliminating special tax preferences or carve-outs whenever possible. This avoids the temptation of government picking winners and losers in the tax code and essentially driving up tax rates for all of us. Overall, the economic evidence clearly showcases the success of states that have followed the lead of Ronald Reagan and enacted pro-growth tax reforms that reduce burdensome tax rates, just like the 1981 tax cuts did federally. The 50 laboratories of democracy give us numerous examples of this every year. As we pause to reflect and celebrate the start of the Reagan tax-cutting experiment 40 years ago now this weekend, we acknowledge that President Reagan's work isn't yet done. We all need to look to create fairer and more pro-growth tax systems at the federal and state levels. Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp set a high bar for pro-growth tax reform, but I'm confident our state leaders are up to the challenge, and states will continue to lead with a new wave of pro-taxpayer tax reforms that benefit all Americans. Your state could be next. For more information, visit ALEC.org and richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WEEM-FM in Pendleton, Indiana. Welcome to our new listeners in the Hoosier State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.